Okay, it's 101, 801 in Israel, I think. Welcome, Bruchim Abayim, everybody. Welcome back to Rav Nitzanim. And today we're going to do mixing up, right? Embryonic, and who, what do you do? And unfortunately, although these cases are rare, these cases actually do happen in practice. So, but that's all I will say, and we'll let you take over. Bakasha, Rabbi, it's all yours.
Amazing. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Thank you so much to everyone for being here with us, again, for our learning. For this exploration of halachic and ethical issues in the field of fertility treatment, particularly emerging issues from the past, say, decade or two, and even things that are still on the horizon. And so, yeah, these questions about misimplantation, that's what our focus will be for today. Last week, we talked about surplus embryos, right, in the process of IVF, in producing embryos or pre-embryos that can be used for eventually for a live birth. So we talked about what happens when in the IVF process, you make quite a number of these pre-embryos. They're extra. And what is their status afterwards? The stakes in that question are really, you know, personal feelings. How does one relate to these things, you know, that are, carry within the DNA to be a human being? And certainly in Israel, but also in other countries, there's a financial question at hand. Who's responsible for bearing the weight of keeping, these, pre-embryos, preserved? The question that we're going to look at today, in some ways, is much higher stakes. And the question is, what happens when we have these fertility clinics, IVF clinics, that are responsible for taking the sperm, the egg, putting them together, performing the fertilization in vitro, right, in the laboratory, and then taking that pre-embryo and returning it to a human womb so it can become a person. What happens when there's a mix-up? What happens when that beginning of an embryo, which will eventually become a fetus, what happens if it ends up not in the womb of the mother that gave the original genetic material, but someone else who wasn't expecting that pre-embryo inside? And as we think about these issues, it's worth being conscious of the fact that oftentimes when people are going through fertility treatments, right, there's emotional weight and there can be physical difficulty. There's a lot that goes, there's the cost. So there's that cluster of things going on, the challenge of going through a fertility journey, makes it hard to face a scenario where there's been a mix-up, where you'll have, in all likelihood, one couple that was trying to start a pregnancy and suddenly, even though they're able to make a viable pre-embryo, now it's no longer available to them. On the flip side, you have a couple that similarly has been trying to have a child for quite some time, and suddenly a pregnancy has started successfully. And the fact that it's not that they're genetic material, they may still feel like this is it. At least we have a pregnancy that started. And so we're dealing with really high stakes questions of who is going to take this child home. And it sort of builds upon these broader questions of what is our account of parenthood within halakha and within the law, as the case may be. So that's what our focus will be for today. So I'm going to pull up the slides. Let's see if we can get this up here. All right, I would appreciate if you just get this up if once you're seeing the slides on the screen. Oh, I'm not seeing thumbs yet, so let me try that again. Let's see here.
It says that it's loading, so it may just take some time.
Your connection
is a little bit slow.
Let me see if I can hear
your voice, but you're freezing, so it could be
oh
great connection.
Oh yikes! Let me see if I can try to fix that. Okay, all right. I think this is working now. Let's give it another try. Thanks for bearing with me, everybody. All right, if you can give me that thumbs up if you see the slides.
Started. There we go.
Awesome. Amazing. All right. So here we go. So we're talking about these cases of misimplantation. As I come and mentioned before, there are real cases that happen where embryos, pre-embryos are mixed up. There was notable case that happened relatively recently in Israel. This is a 2023 article about the 2018 case, so there was a more recent one as well, also with Asuta. Asuta is a company that runs a number of clinics, health clinics here in Israel. And there was this case of a mix-up, where it, as best you could tell, based on checking the DNA of the child, it seemed like the wrong embryo ended up in the wrong gestational mother, the wrong womb. And now what? Now what's gonna, whose kid is it? Right? And that's, this when, in a case like this, we really have to, we have two competing claims. And if the competing claims rest upon this much deeper, in a sense, philosophical or legal question of what is our kind of parenthood? What is that makes one a parent? Now, for what it's worth, the rate of these errors happens is quite low. All right, the numbers are bringing here from the U.S. A risk rate of 0.00005%. So pretty, this doesn't happen all too often, but that doesn't change the fact that these cases do happen. Now, the reason why it matters to note that it's extremely uncommon to have a mix-up is because there are those, most notably the Tzitzeliezer of Waldenburg, who early on in the story of the halachic reception of IVF was actually opposed to IVF altogether. The truth is, in the early years of IVF, going back to the late 60s, early 70s, there was a fair amount of opposition to using IVF as a form of treatment altogether, for a number of possible fears. In the Catholic world, their primary concern was that IVF might involve in pre-embryos that become fetuses, that become babies that actually have significant illnesses or other sorts of issues that might arise in the process of development, which weren't anticipated. Right, we're experimenting with babies, and there was a concern about that. In the Jewish world, a lot of the concern was about this. What's going to happen if we mix things up? We lose track of who's the parent and who's the child. And the fact that it happens so rarely compared to the high rates of families having children that they had hoped to have, it seems like it pays off, right? It seems that even though there is this risk, it doesn't seem like the risk is high enough to justify being opposed to IVF, which is why, broadly speaking, in the halachic world, in most of the jurisdictions in which we live, IVF has become a normal part of fertility treatment. And yet, we need to acknowledge that extended IVF as a form of treatment is going to involve some number of errors, and we have to have a game plan for what happens. Okay. So as we think about parenthood, right, and looking at the bioethical literature, broadly speaking, we can talk about two sorts of accounts of what makes someone a parent. As we'll see once we get ahead, there are more than these two options, but I want to focus on these two to begin with because they're, I suppose, the most commonly addressed approaches, and it's certainly the ones that are most apparent in halachic writing. And those are the genetic account of parenthood and the gestational account of parenthood. The genetic account of parenthood, as one might guess, is whoever has contributed the genetic material, the gametes, to make a child, those are the parents, right? And so whoever gave the sperm, whoever gave the eggs, because the way that a baby is made is through sperm, eggs, the DNA crosses and goes through meiosis and then creates an embryo and a fetus. So that's what makes you a parent. The other account would say that it is gestational, the gestational role that makes one a parent, namely carrying a fetus in your womb, that is what makes you a parent. There are all sorts of pluses and minuses to each of these approaches. Preliminarily, we might point out that only on the genetic account of parenthood do we have a clear account of fatherhood, right? If you think that what makes someone a parent is carrying a baby through to term through pregnancy, it's hard to imagine what a father is. And if we say that parenthood is defined by genes, then at least we understand where fathers and mothers both fit in. Now, there are also upsides to the gestational account where it feels like if you're the one who put in the labor, the work, labor, carefully chosen word there. If you've invested in bringing this child into being, you're the one who should have the rights and responsibilities of parenthood. There's certain logic to that. There's also a, we might ask from a different standpoint, which is when the law thinks about, and that's sort of any legal system, considers who should we deem the parents, and that includes both rights and responsibilities. So we want to be able to make sure that we can, in every case, identify who the parents are. Now, on the one hand, it seems like the gestational mother is the one that's easier to identify, right? At face value, if you're there at the birth, we saw who gave who gave birth to the baby. At the same time, if you're not there for the birth, a long time after, we will always have your DNA record, which we can trace to your genetic mother and genetic father, which we can't do with gestational birth. And so, those who see the capacity for assuring that we can know who the parents are will debate which is the right metric to use. There are upsides to both the gestational and genetic accounts. So halakhically, there's been debate about this amongst poskim, which of these positions regarding motherhood should take precedence. Rabbi Tzvi Reisman, in an essay he wrote a couple years back, does a nice sort of overview of this of the standing positions amongst leading rabbinic figures. I didn't bother translating, but the point is that it's a list, okay? And he says as follows. So point one, those who think that the pundekei, that's a term for the surrogate, or what he means by that is the gestational mother. Those who say the gestational mother should be recognized by halakha as the mother, Rav Waldenberg, Rav Eliyahu, Rav Yisraeli, Rav Gol, okay. And then there are some other rabbis who say, number two, that maybe it's the mother who is the genetic parent, right, who gave the egg. And then there are these three various versions of, they're kind of both the mothers to some degree. And as he writes at the end, here's what's really notable. Rabbi Reisman says he heard from Shmuel Arbach and Yashiv, Sheloni Tana Sopa Noseza. There's no way to actually reach a firm conclusion regarding this question of which mother should we treat halachically as the mother. Because there's just no source material on it. At the end of the day, this halachic question is really not about what it says in the sources. It's really about just whatever we think makes the most sense. And this point is stated in some of the writing of the rabbis who are mentioned here. So at some point, it becomes a svara question. It becomes a, what do we think seems most reasonable in considering an account of parenthood? That said, each of these rabbis tries to find sources that we can turn to. Now, this isn't going to be our issue for tonight, but there are a number of rabbinic scholars who point to various stories in the Torah that might help us make sense of this question of whom should we consider the halachic mother. There's a midrash about Yosef and Dina, the children of Rachel and Leah, respectively, who apparently got switched in utero somehow miraculously. And so that's used as sort of a reference point of how we think about who do we consider the mother? Do we care about conception or birth? There's the story of Sarah, who turns to Hagar, and Hagar is meant to birth on her behalf. So we have these stories that are discussed, but many of the, even those who discuss these sources will end up saying at the end, but at the end of the day, it's just stories, right? These agadot, these midrashim, that it's not clear that they can be used as firm halachic source material. And so if we really want reliable sources, they're not a lot to work. What I do want to study together this evening is what is arguably one source, which is agreed upon by all as a halachic source that is worth looking at, but as we'll see, it might not get us exactly where we need to get to. I'm sorry I didn't even write it here, but this is a passage from the Gemara in Yevamot on Sadi Zayin Amud Bet 97b. And there we have this one passage in the Gemara that might lead us towards some sort of thinking about this question. So let's try to go through this Gemara and we'll see it can lead us towards an answer. Whom does the halacha consider the mother, the genetic mother or the gestational mother? The Gemara goes as follows. Tashma. Shnei achim te'omim geri. Let's say we have two twin brothers who are converts. V'chem shucharim, and also the two twin brothers who are freed slaves. We'll focus on the convert case for now, though it's parallel to freed slaves. Lo chultin v'lo mi'abin ve'in chayvim mishum isharach. So you have two twin brothers, they convert together to Judaism, meaning they were not Jewish. They were born not Jewish, and then they convert to Judaism, each of them. they do not perform chalitza or yibum, right? And for the chalitza and yibum are these, or is what would be performed if one of the brothers was to be married and then dies before having children, and comes in the brother and either performs levirate marriage or the ritual of chalitza. So chalitza and yibum do not happen. And similarly, the prohibition of karet, if the one were to sleep with the wife of the other. Now, the underlying principle here is, was referred to elsewhere in the Gemara, including elsewhere in the Sugya, that we say, Gershinit Gayer, Kekatan Shinoladam. A convert, upon converting, is like an entirely new person. And because of this, we say that for halakhic purposes, even if two brothers, even two twin brothers, were to convert, meaning they each convert, they are not considered related to each other, halakhically. And therefore, all the things that we would say about halakhic brothers, namely the requirement of chalitza and yibum, or the prohibition of incest and sleeping with one's brother's wife, would not apply. Because from the vantage point of the halakha, of the Torah, they're not considered related. Okay. Right, so that case arguably seems straightforward. Now, case two. Hayta hora tan shelo b'kedusha, b'leida tan b'kedusha. What would happen if their conception was not in sanctity, by which we mean at a time which they were not Jewish, but their birth was in sanctity at a point in which they're Jewish, right? So follow the colors were on the green arrow in the middle. At the point of conception, their mother, who carried them, was not Jewish, but while pregnant with the children, she converts, such that by the time they are born to a Jewish mother, and thus they are Jewish as well. In a case such as this one, lo chutzin v'lo meyavmin, so they don't perform a chalitza and yibum, aval chayavim mishmenei sherach, but they do have the prohibition on sleeping with one's brother's wife. But we'll get back to case two in a moment. Case three, ha'taratan v'latan yidusha, let's say that the conception and birth were in sanctity, namely, you just had a woman who converted at some point, and then had children. Harehim ki yisraelim l'chol divreihem. Okay, they're Jewish for all purposes. Okay, so case one and two and three seem pretty straightforward. If a woman converts and she has children, great, they're Jewish. And if in case one, right, if two brothers, even if they're twin brothers, are not Jewish, they're born not Jewish, and then they each convert, they're not considered related. The funny case, and perhaps the relevant case, is case number two. In case number two, they were conceived not in sanctity, but born in sanctity. And the halacha, the Gemara here tells us that they do not perform a chalitza and yibum, but they do have the prohibition of ish ach, of sleeping with a brother's wife. Now, what's important to understand in the background, as noted on the bottom of the screen, is that chalitza and yibum are obligations that fall upon paternal siblings, paternal brothers, and the prohibition on incest applies to maternal siblings. And so, essentially what the Gemara is saying is that in case two, where the conception is at a point where the mother is not Jewish, but the birth is at a point where the mother is Jewish, then these brothers are considered maternal brothers, but not paternal brothers. If it is the case that in this scenario, they are considered maternal brothers, then that would imply that it is the mother that is, that that even prior to their being born, they're already, if it is the case that in this scenario they are considered maternal brothers, that would imply that the point at which maternal brotherhood is determined is at birth rather than at conception. And if that's the case, then that would seem to imply that motherhood is determined at birth rather than at conception. And hence it is the gestational mother, the mother who births the children, that is deemed by halacha as the mother. That was complicated. Let me say it one more time. The Gemara seems to imply that in a case where a non-Jewish woman becomes pregnant with two twins, twin brothers, for argument's sake, then converts, and then the children are born, in such a case, these brothers are considered maternal siblings, but not paternal siblings. They share a mother, but not a father. That would seem to imply that the point at which the maternal relationship is determined, halakhically, is at the point of birth, not at the point of conception. Fatherhood seems to be determined at the point of conception, but motherhood seems to be determined at the point of birth, which would arguably imply that it is the birthing of the child that that makes one a halachic mother. That's how the argument goes. Okay. It's crafty, this attempt at reading this Gemara and trying to find within it a claim about genetic versus gestational motherhood. However, it might not get us as far as we need it to. Here's why. I'll start with the second point, which is that it might be that this is all talking about a very local issue, which is about the halachic status of conversion, right? This peculiar case where you're kind of reborn when you're converted, and so how does that apply to fetuses in utero? So it might be that this really just tells us nothing about our general conception of motherhood. But more importantly, though there are some rabbinic scholars who want to read this Gemara as saying that this Gemara proves that gestation, or birthing, it determines motherhood. But there are two possibilities of how we might read what actually has happened in the Gemara. All we see in the Gemara is that there is a case in which there is a motherhood is determined by gestation. However, it is a case in which they also share a genetic mother. Right? We're not talking about the case that we're imagining in IVF treatment, where you would have two different women, one who is the genetic mother and one who is the gestational mother. We're talking about a case where it's the same person. And so it might be the case that it is both, that in order to be a halachic mother, you need to be both the genetic and the gestational mother. Right? The fact that the Gemara concludes that the gestational mother is the mother, well, it's actually the mother who is both the genetic and the gestational mother. Alternatively, it might be the case that gestation can make you a mother, but maybe it's also the case that genetics could make you a mother. Right? This is noted in an essay by Rabbi Ezra Bick. He just says it's not clear that the Gemara proves that, right? It's not clear that the Gemara proves that only gestation can amount to motherhood. It might be the case that either one of these things is sufficient, right? If we could imagine a case where you were only the genetic mother, maybe that would be sufficient too. So that's all to say that though this Gemara seems like it is kind of getting at this question of where does motherhood kick in, it just doesn't really tell us enough to reach a firm halakha conclusion. And that's where we're stuck. So we may well be left with what was already said before by Rabbi Reisman in the name of Rabbi Shulman Auerbach and Rabbi Yashiv, which is we might just need to make this determination, misvara, based on our best attempt at reasoning for the answer. It may well be that the halachic sources available to us are just so distant from the case that we're dealing with that we have no choice but to try to figure this one out on our own. So now what do we do? I'd like to suggest a way that we might think about this question. As noted before, rabbinic scholars have argued in favor of both the genetic possibility and the gestational possibility. I'm sorry, we'll call the genetic account or the gestational account of parenthood, or specifically of motherhood, and have their various reasons for doing so. But the truth is, when we think about fertility treatment, we don't really like either one of them. And that's because there are some people, some couples, assume we're talking for the time being, we'll focus on heterosexual couples. There are couples who have available to them sperm and a womb, but don't have access to an egg and need an egg donation. But in a case like that, we would like to consider the mother who is carrying the baby, who received the donation of an egg, as the mother. That's what we'd like to think. And similarly, there are some couples who have access to sperm and an egg, but don't have a womb to use, don't have the gestational environment to use, and they will make use of the donation of the help of a surrogate. But we'd like to think that the mother who contributed the genetic material is the mother. Meaning, there are lots of people, there are families that would like to have children, children that they think of as their own, children that they would like us to think of as their own. But lots of different sets of people have different sets of biological resources available to them between the egg, the sperm, and the womb. And so how, we would like it to be the case that even though there are multiple possibilities of what it is that you have available to you, you can still become a parent in the eyes of the halakha, in the eyes of the Torah, in the eyes of the law. And so there's a downside to both the genetic and the gestational account because we want it to be the case that sometimes genetic mothers are moms and sometimes gestational mothers are moms, depending on how the case goes. For this reason, I want to introduce what is considered in the bioethical literature as a third possible account of parenthood, which is the intentional or causal account of parenthood. The intentional and causal are slightly different, but for our purposes, we'll treat them as the same. For those who are interested in some of the deeper ethical, philosophical parts of the story, there's what to tease apart between those two. But I'd like to talk about this third account, and I'm interested in it because it doesn't seem to be addressed anywhere explicitly in halakhic writing that I'm familiar with. And yet, I have some sense that many rabbis intuit it and end up kind of ruling along the lines of the intentional or causal account, even when they don't admit to doing so. Because at the end of the day, what we'd like to have happen is that whoever tries to make a baby, we'd like to consider them to be the parents. And the intentional account basically says exactly that. Whoever it is who takes the steps to intentionally cause it to be the case that there's a baby born into the world, that person or that set of persons is the parent, or they are the parents. That's what the intentional account would argue, right? That we don't use a biological marker to determine who are the parents. Instead, we use what is essentially a somewhat, I guess, I don't want to say socially constructed, but it's a marker that can't really be determined based on biological evidence alone, right? We witness to what happened in order to know who caused it to be the case that there are children, or some related, formulated differently, who is it who tried to make there be a baby, who wanted there to be a baby? And those people are the parents. And the truth is, this is kind of what happens, where oftentimes, even rabbis who will rule one way or the other in terms of whether they think that fundamentally the halakhic mother is the genetic mother or the gestational mother, in most cases we'll end up trying to find a way to say that whether you are someone who needed the help of a surrogate or whether you're someone who needed the help of gamete donation, I suppose whether that's egg donation or sperm donation, that you still get to be considered the parents. Well, that's kind of what we want to be the case, and that is basically a way of adopting the intentional account. The question is, do we have any sort of way of grounding this in our tradition? I'd like to suggest the following line of reasoning of why the intentional account may well be reflected in the tradition of the Torah, even if it's not exactly halakhic in the conventional sense. The Gemara in Kiddushin, building off of the Sifra, notes a parallel between the honor that is due to God and the honor that is due to one's parents. That there are quite a number of similarities between how we are meant to relate to our parents and how we're meant to relate to God. There's an obligation today in the Torah of kavod, of honor. There's an obligation today in the Torah of yirah, of reverence. And that parallelism is claimed by the Sifra and then quoted in the Gemara as being the outgrowth of the reality that shloshtan shutfin vo, the three of them, namely the two parents and God, are all of them, the three of them, partners in creating us. Now that's a funny claim because what exactly do we mean when we say that God was involved in creating us? Now some people might be familiar with the way that the Gemara in Nida reads this Tannaitic claim and suggests that the same way that our genetic fathers and mothers give us some of the stuff, the material that makes babies. They didn't know exactly how sperm and eggs work, but they thought that there were certain parts of the body that derive from the genetic father and some from the genetic mother. So too, God gives a portion, right? The claim there in the Gemara Nida is that the genetic father gives the loven, the white stuff, which apparently refers to the bones and so on. The mother gives the odem, the red stuff, that's meant to be muscles and blood and so on, and God gives the spirit and the senses. Okay, that's really a way of reading what this claim is, Shoshanshu, but it seems to be that we're presuming a sort of more conventional account of where we think God fits into the story. Where God fits into the story of the making of us is not that God swoops in and like adds a few drops of, you know, fairy dust to the mixture inside, you know, in utero. Rather, God is involved in the causing it to be that we exist. In fact, God is involved in all of creation through the intending that the world should be. Right, when we think about Christianness, throughout the world, there are various cultures that have ways of talking about creation. And oftentimes, as scholars will note, creationists are tied up with our account of how we think of all things coming into being. And there are lots of creationists that, from various cultures, that try to suggest that what makes God or the creator, in fact, the creator, where the role that the creator plays is taking of some of the stuff of itself, himself, herself, themselves, and using that material, this primordial divine material, to make the world. This is a number of traditions, in certain versions of Greek mythology, and elsewhere. What is especially notable about the Jewish tradition is that it's very clear in Reishit, and this is reflected sort of throughout the tradition, right? In Tehillim, in Chazal, that what makes God the creator of the world is not that God used any divine material to make us, but that God willed that the world should be. Baruch she'amar v'haya olam. God creates the world by speaking, by intending for the world to be. And it is through God's intending that the world should be that the world comes into being, and that we credit God with being the creator. And it may well be that that's kind of what we have in mind when we say that God is taking part in our own creation. That God intended for the world and willed the world into being the same way, and we are a part of that world. We are a part of that creation. God wills it, works things out in such a way that we can come into being. Now, that's one's biological parents do more than just intending, but it certainly seems to imply that we do care a lot about who intends for things to be created, and that can be used as a metric for determining, well, then who gets the claim to the thing that is created. And that's the way that we think about God and the world. And we think that there's a clear parallelism between the relation between God's creation and parental creation. Then maybe we have good reason to think that it is intention that makes one a parent. So I have to admit that there are, in the philosophical literature, advantages and disadvantages that are discussed regarding the intentional or causal account. The intentional causal account is favored amongst legal theorists because it fits very nicely into our general account of moral responsibility, right? We think of humans as being responsible for the things that they do because they intend to do so, right? If you commit a crime willingly or if you commit a crime unwillingly, the stakes are different. The implications are different, right? Well, if we think of parenthood as being part of our thinking about moral responsibility, right? You brought the kid into the world. You're going to try to make the kid to be. So now the kid is your responsibility. It's your problem. If you didn't want to have the responsibilities of parenthood, you shouldn't have tried to bring a kid into the world. So it fits nicely into our general account of moral responsibility. And the nice thing is that anyone with any set of biological resources can become a parent, right? Meaning not whether you're a couple that has only access to sperm and egg, or sperm and womb, or only an egg and neither sperm nor womb, or even a single person or a couple who actually, as it turns out, has none of these three biological elements needed, but they get those donated from other people, and they have a sperm donor, an egg donor, and a surrogate, they still get to be the parents because they're still the ones that orchestrated the birth of the child. So there's something very elegant about that, that it allows. It is an account of parenthood that sort of allows anyone, irrespective of your biological limitations, to be a parent. The disadvantages. First, though it does fit nicely into our general account of moral responsibility, it doesn't fit so nicely into our general account of familial responsibility. We tend to think that family members have some sort of special relationship to one another, some sort of special responsibility towards one another. But we don't think that the relationship between siblings has to do with an intending of that the siblings should come into being, or grandparents, right? We tend to presume that family is a category that more broad, that exists in our moral thinking, and clearly it's not always the familial relationship isn't always brought into being through intention. So that's a challenge in terms of how we think about family more broadly, and as is discussed at great length in the subfield of philosophy of the family. The other disadvantage is the difficulty to prove or to trace. In other words, it's important to us that when a baby comes into the world, we need to know who has the rights to this child, and similarly, who's responsible for this child. Who's the one that we can call on to take it home? And there are ways, if we're going to go with the gestational account, okay, so whoever gave birth to the child, it's your kid, take it home. Or if we're going to use genetics, so fine, do a quick DNA test, and we'll figure out who's connected to this kid, you take them home. But to figure out, let's say we don't know who the intentional parents are. How are we supposed to find them? Right? In fact, how do we even know in the moment what kind of intention you had, or whether you had intention? Right? So though there's something very elegant about the intentional account, it does pose problems when applied in reality, where it's hard to know what exactly constitutes the right kind of intention. And how much intention has to be had? How much do you have to prove you have that intention? And what happens if we lose track of you? So I will admit there are downsides to it, but I do think there's real benefit to thinking more seriously about how we can incorporate the intentional account into our halakhic thinking because of the upsides that it offers. Okay. There's another way of looking at this question. As a note about that same article I mentioned before by Rabbi Reisman, which really has nothing to do with genetics, labor, and so on. In fact, it has very little to do with birth. As Rabbi Reisman points out, when we think about parenthood, this is true as we think about halachic parenthood, and the truth is, it's true when we think about parenthood more generally. There are multiple elements of being a parent, right? When we talk about who is the halachic parent, well, parents are the parent-child relationship is expressed in a number of ways. A parent is someone whom you are responsible to mourn for upon their passing. Someone that you're obligated to respect and revere. A parent is someone who is obligated to perform for their children certain mitzvot, like to teach them Torah, perform Brit Milah, or Pidyon HaBen. There are also prohibitions on incest. There may be financial responsibilities. There's actually a lot of different elements of parenthood, and it might be the case, and even in philosophical literature, this is discussed, but it might be that what makes you a parent in one regard is different from what makes you a parent in a different regard. And so Rabbi Reisman says, it's not so clear to him how we should figure out parenthood when it comes to, say, yichus, namely your personal status, like questions of your being a Jew or being a Kohen or who you're related to, whether we should follow the gestational or genetic accounts. But he says, in asking a question about an embryo mix-up, at that point we're asking the question, who's meant to take care of this child? And when we ask the question, who's meant to take care of this child, the question at hand is not who in some abstract sense is the parent, but what is best for this child? At some point, the child is already here. And we're not, as he claims, we don't have a great way of determining who is the authentic parent for these other issues like lineage, incest, kibbutz ha'im, and so on. But what we can do, says our Reisman, is we can put those issues aside. Maybe we can be machmir. We can defer to both possibilities, genetic and gestational motherhood, in those kinds of cases. But when it comes to taking the child home and being responsible for raising the child, it can't be both. And so we're going to have to bracket this one issue off and look at it separately. And it says, and we're looking at what's going to be good for this child. So the welfare of the child really should be the determining factor. For this, he turns to the Shulchan Aruch in its discussion of what happens in the case of divorce. We're talking about who takes responsibility, who has custody for children in divorce. Although it is rare these days that Bati Din handle these questions, it has historically happened that Batei Din have dealt with these sorts of issues. And the Shulchan Aruch, building off the claims of the Gemara, the Rishonim notes that there's a, that as a general rule, all children, this is the presumption of the Gemara, that as a general rule, all children should be assigned to the custody of the mother until the age of six. After the age of six, boys should go to their father and girls should go to their mothers. It seems to be working on the presumption that they're living in a world in which, gender roles are pretty rigidly defined, and the way that boys are meant to be taught in order to learn how to work a trade, earn a living, is the what is the kind of thing they're going to learn from their father. And the same way that the that girls are going to end up learning how to do the perform the tasks that are performed by women from their mothers. That's that seems to be the presumption. But the Rama, building off of the tshuva of the Maharam Padua, says the dafka shenir. I'm looking at the second paragraph. Haga, v'dafka shir ela b'din shetov l'ba liot im ima, aval amir alahem shetov l'ayot shir b'it aviyah, in em yuchola l'kuf shetia ima. Says the Rama, it's true that we have a general principle, based on the Gemara, that boys go to their fathers and girls go to their mothers. But if the Beit Din thinks that in a particular scenario, in a particular circumstance, it would be better for a child to be with the other parent, then that's what they should do. And based on this, what has become the norm, you know, it's certainly in Israeli Batei Din that face these questions, is always to go to the Rama and say, based on this, this principle for the Rama, the question we always ask is, what is best for this child? What is in the best interest of this child? And it might be that's kind of the way that we're meant to think about this question. Now, in a case like this one, with the misimplantation, making the determination of who's who best to give the child to is kind of tricky. Like, what does mean better for the child? We don't really know. And especially because, as happened in the Asuta case that occurred in Israel recently, they knew that the DNA was wrong, meaning that the embryo had been implanted into the wrong, carrying mother, but they hadn't yet figured out who the genetic parents were. And it was going to take a great deal of work to figure that out. Not to mention a great deal of stress and, trauma for a lot of people involved. And so, there was a sense amongst many of the rabbinic scholars dealing with it that it's better for the child to stay with the gestational mother, the birthing mother in this case, simply because it'll just be so much of a hassle to try to figure out when it's born, how we're going to track down the genetic parent. But that's a tricky one, in all honesty. The truth is, one of the interesting pieces of this story is the judgment of Shlomo. Rabbi Reisman notes that, in many ways, this question that we face about to whom to assign parenthood, and specifically motherhood, is in many ways reminiscent of this biblical story, that seems so far-fetched and yet, in a sense, has come to life in these misimplantation questions, where we have the story of King Solomon, who asks God for great wisdom, and then suddenly is faced with this real case, where two women approach him, and they have before them two babies, only one of them is still living. And each one of them says, the living baby is mine, and the one that is not living was switched out. So comes King Solomon and says, you know what we should do? Get a sword, cut the child in half, and each one gets half. And immediately the woman who was in fact the mother of that child asked the king, give the baby, the living baby, to the other woman, the other mother, so that the child won't be killed. And this leads Shlomo to say, it must be that you are the mother. The fact that you care so much about the child is indicative of the fact that you are the mother. Now there is this question, starting from the Gemara, but really at great length in later halachic writing about what happened here? Like how could King Shlomo use this test to determine parenthood? On what grounds does he do so, right? When we study the Masechet Sanhedrin, the halachic tradition around jurisprudence, we have a very high standard for bringing together evidence to prove one way or another regarding a conclusion. And here, Shlomo just kind of on whim makes up this experiment, which only it's not that reliable, right? He thinks it works, but maybe he's wrong. How valid is the test administered by Shlomo Melech? So there's some rabbis who go so far as to say that really, Shlomo knew all along who the mother was. They just did this as an sort of an added piece to the story. But there might be a way to read the story of Mishpat Shlomo, where either he's claiming that the mother who has greater compassion is must have been the birthing mother, right, post facto. But it might be that what he has in mind is something along the lines of the one who cares more about the child is the one who is best suited to be the parent of this child. Right? And that we once there's a child before us, right? We're not talking in the abstract before a child is born, but right now there's a child before us. The determining factor we should use is who's going to care best for this child. And so this line of reason that Rabbi Reisman introduces that regarding this sort of question, we should ask what is in the best interest of the child may itself be rooted in Tanakh, in Mishpat Shlomo. Now, for the record, Rabbi Reisman has an odd suggestion where he says, really, we should assign parenthood to the genetic parents because it says there's machloket regarding who is the halachic mother, but everyone agrees who the halachic father is, genetic father. So that gives precedence to the genetic parents. That strikes me as a bit of a circumvention of the question. And he also makes an interesting point, which is that he claims in the earlier years, in earlier writing on this issue, more rabbinic scholars sort of leaned towards privileging gestational motherhood. And with time, as there's been more of an appreciation of genetic material, DNA sequencing, and so on, there's been a shift amongst rabbinic scholars towards privileging genetic parenthood. That stuff is worth considering. But I do think that it's worth wondering whether what we're actually want to move towards is something like an intentional account, where the questions that we're asking are not really biological questions, but questions about who willed for this child to be, and perhaps distinctly, who is going to care most for this child? Who's best positioned to care for this child? So those are, I think, the sorts of issues we want to think about. Coming up ahead, in a minute, I'll take questions as well as look at what we have in the chat. But just looking ahead, some of the issues that we have coming up in the next few weeks. Next week, Bezrat Hashem, we're talking about artificial wombs. Just in September, the FDA had its first major meeting to discuss what the implications are of artificial wombs and what that means for really primarily questions around treatment of neonates and how we think about research ethics. That's an issue to work out there. And then Almer's going to be talking about surrogacy, the cost of cryopreservation, and new kinds of testing on children. On fetuses regarding polygenic risk scores. So a lot of exciting material come up ahead. I'm going to stop the share here, and I'm going to take a look at the chat and then other questions from the crowd, if there are any. All right, I'm taking a look here. Last week, a question came in the last minute. If a primo is discarded, should be buried. Super interesting. There are some places, apparently, meaning not in Israel or places where Jews tend to spend their time, but various parts of the world, primarily in South America, where there are various rituals that have been adopted to either place them in sort of some special container or so on, maybe even to go so far as to bury them. In the U.S., this has become politicized because related to questions of whether, in a case of abortion, a fetus needs to be buried and question around personhood, but there are places where this is done. I've seen no suggestion amongst rabbinic writing that that's something that's required. In large part, that's because A, burial in halachic thinking is tied up very deeply with the notion of the human body being a reflection of the divine image and not wanting to respect the image of the human body. And these embryos don't have that sort of image. You're looking at like a straw, and inside that straw is a little teeny tiny cell or a cluster of cells. And so because it's so unlike a human, the obligation of bury wouldn't apply. So I have in Jewish writing, I haven't seen that. All right, next up, the womb is more than just a vessel for birth of fetus. There's genetic material exchange in utero. So yes, thank you to Naomi. Yeah, this is as the rabbinic conversation develops. Funny way of thinking about it. There's there's an appreciation that the question just gets more and more complicated. It's true. There's certainly in terms of epigenetics, as best I understand, there is an impact in utero from the gestational mother. There are also questions which I don't think we're going to address it in this class, but what there are other ways of sort of impacting the DNA. You can there are these new attempts to make use of mitochondrial DNA so that you can sort of add parents to the genetic roster. And so that what when we talk about genetic parenthood, that's actually broader of a concept than what we might have thought previously. So you're right. It's not it, we should probably shouldn't limit ourselves to genetic versus gestational. But really, I guess the question we probably say we want the way to formulate the question is birthing, carrying the baby to term, the thing that determines motherhood, halachic motherhood, legal motherhood, or is it the primary or initial genetic contribution? Even though it's true there's epigenetic influence also in utero. Interesting. I'll just note that in sociological research that's been done on these issues around fertility treatment, they find that even though a lot of people have the intuition that the birthing mother should be the one that is that's seen at the end of the day as the mother, just because we see the baby get born and that's the person that, like, carried this child through 9 months of pregnancy, you know, we are genetically predisposed to care for our genetic offspring, just how we're built, you know, like all the other creatures on Earth. And we're not built genetically to care for our gestational offspring, like the things that we birth, in the same way. And so oftentimes when people are interviewed afterwards in cases of gamete donation, like egg donation or sperm donation versus surrogates, I guess we could call uterus donation, so to speak. It is more common for gamete donors to regret their decision and wonder what happened to the children than for surrogates to regret their decision and wonder what happened to the children. And there's the suggestion that it might be because we're built genetically to be on the lookout for a genetic offspring, in a way that we're not built to do, for a gestational offspring. And people have questioned whether that should be a factor that we consider. Are we built emotionally to our genetic offspring in a particular way? But again, that's, we'll go beyond the scope of what we're getting at today. All right. Gail mentioned children want to require genetic information, as so all four parents are important. At some point, it may well be that one can have multiple parents for multiple kinds of things. And then, as we said before, we just have to figure out for each relevant element of parenthood, who is the parent who takes that position. Suzanne, Judith Hauptman has written that the genetic mother should be the halacha mother, but I don't know if it's been published. Awesome. I'd be curious to see it. I'm unfamiliar with her writing on this particular issue, but I'd love to see it. Did not Isaac ask Esau for hunted food to learn his filial intention? Huh. Interesting. I suppose we could go down that route. Thank you, Gersha. I mean, the suggestion, it sounds like that there's an intentional component of sibling relationship also. Though I suppose that might be a way to determine how much Esav is or Yaakov is committed to the relationship, but maybe not what forms the relationship. But it's worth considering whether we can use the intentional account as a part of how we think about sibling relationships and other familial relationships as well. I think there's some skepticism about that. At some point, what makes you siblings is the fact that you share some sort of biological material or experience. But I wonder whether it's worth a thing along those lines. Can we access the slides? Yes, I'm sorry, I was in touch with Rabbi Cohen before. We couldn't share them. Let me take a moment and share the slides with anyone who's interested. I'll put the link in the chat in case anyone is interested in seeing that. Great. And is there anything else here? All lines of Shamos. Yeah, so Gil mentioned this point about Shamos, which we discussed at the end of last session about Prandu has divine names. Is there one? Okay, I see open adoption addresses, rights of child, right? This grows a child and sperm donor. Yeah, where adoption fits into the story is also an important question. My hunch is that we don't really need to account for adoption because adoption and under any circumstances is a person may well have had what we'll call natural parents, and then parenthood is shifted over, handed over to the adopting parents, such that what we don't need to fit adoption.
No,
I don't
the
think.
The point is about
yes,
the right of the
please.
Child. The point is about that the child now wants to know that future children, it's not from adoption, it's from the child, looking at the child.
That for sure. As an, at some, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, because later on, even with, like I was saying about sperm donors, the offspring of sperm donors feel that they have a right to all that genetic information as well. So who is the parent may be, for the point of view of the child, is not as important.
For sure. And you know, it may well be that we say that children have the right to information about their genetic heritage. They have the right to know who their genetic parents are, and yet still say that, but for legal or social or halakhic purposes, the people who are their parents, who play the role of their parents, are the gestational parent, the intentional parent, and so on. So even if we say that children have a right to know who gave them their genetic material, that doesn't need to lead us to the conclusion that the genetic parents are the ones who hold the legal or halakhic or social position of parents, of the rights and responsibilities of parents. We have a couple minutes, so if anybody still has anything else, questions or thoughts they want to add.
Are there any Jewish sources that suggest that children have such a right? Rights aren't really very common in Jewish sources. Are there any Jewish sources that suggest that a child has the right to know who their genetic parent is?
So, wow.
Excuse me, there is.
Yes.
There is, and it's called the fact that there is no conception of adoption in halacha. So therefore, you can raise the child, but the child is never considered totally yours, which is what this would be interesting as to genetic, the relationship. But in terms of halachic, you know, it's like the son of a Kohen, adopted the son of a Kohen, does not become a Kohen.
In terms of the particular question around the right to information about one's genetic origins, there's only a little bit of halakhic writing, and I even wonder whether it's worth shifting around some of our topics, because there's a lot to sort of unpack here. But the short of it is, okay, in terms of explicit halakhic address, discussion of this issue, so obviously there's nothing in, you know, the Gemara or, you know, traditional sources about, like, figuring out who your genetic parents specifically are, the presumption that you more or less know, and that there's no reason why you wouldn't know. But this question of, as you say, though a lot of material doesn't often use the language of rights, it's not unheard of, having certain sorts of, entitlements. The short of it is there's very little. In terms of a concept of a right to information. And if we're to say there is such a right, it would stem from, I guess, we'd have to say from extra halakhic thinking, or extra halakhic sources. But I want to think about that one a little more carefully. So maybe, next week we'll address that at least briefly.
Is it
yeah, Richard, and then we'll,
it seems to me that
his Kohen, gene, is that child a Kohen?
I'm sorry, say that again. What's the case
is
you're describing?
The child of a Kohen who's bequeathed his Kohenic gene a Kohen?
So there's a fair amount of debate of what exactly happens. The general oftentimes the default presumption is to presume that children are not Kohenim, meaning rabbis tend to be very antsy about such cases. And so the presumption that, any case where there's other sorts of parental, contribution that we call into question the Kohenic status of the child. But my own hunch is that, it is clear that the Kohanim are described in the Torah as being Mizera Aharon HaKohen, as being derived from the seed, the semen, the genetic material of Aharon. And so my own hunch is to think that, you should be the Kohen says should pass on from if your father is your genetic father is a Kohen. I think my own hunch is that should pass on regardless. But some rabbis were nervous, and so they dafka try to orchestrate things such a way where if you're Kohen, that you should dafka use say a non-Jewish surrogate, and the child isn't even halachically Jewish until after it's born. All sorts of like ways to orchestrate around kihuna. These rabbis are antsy about how to navigate kihuna. So that more often than not, rabbis, rather than giving a fundamental answer, will try to circumvent kihuna issues. But my own hunch, if you're asking, is that kihuna, I think, should be passed on genetically, even if other elements of parenthood are passed on through other means. That's my own hunch on the matter. But I see that the hour is up. So if people have further questions, I'll put it here. My email.
And if the mother is a divorcee.
I guess it would depend on which mother you have in mind. I'm going to pause here. There really is more to discuss here than I think the time will allow for. But first of all, I've just included my email in the chat. So if people have follow-up questions, someone from last week had some follow-up questions that reached out to me with. I still owe you an answer. So feel free to follow up with questions. And Bli Neder, next week I want to get to some of these questions that were raised. One about the right to information about your genetic heritage and siblings, and two regarding these questions around kahuna, how that plays in. So hopefully we'll get to that next week. And thank you everyone for joining us for our learning today.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
It was excellent.